Washington, D.C. to meet President Trump as the country's acting president laid out new policy. So who really holds power in Venezuela? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration is using videos from right-wing influencers in Minnesota to justify sending more immigration officers. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We look at how a social media meme strategy is actually driving policy. Also, Trump called on Congress to pass a health care bill that would not extend Obamacare subsidies. And prosecutors accuse college basketball players of taking bribes to tank games. It is Friday, January 16th. On this day in 2006, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was sworn in as president of Liberia, making her the first elected female head of state on the continent. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There are now as many as 3,000 federal immigration agents on the ground, or they are coming soon to Minneapolis and St. Paul. That is five times the number of Minneapolis police officers. President Trump is threatening to invoke the Insurrection Act against Minnesota. NPR's Meg Anderson says Minnesota residents are tracking the federal agents, and they are protesting.
The observers filming and making noise, those peaceful acts of resistance, even though they're chaotic, are protected by the Constitution. But ICE has responded to some confrontations over the last week with a lot of aggression. Over the last 5 days, NPR reporters, myself included, we've seen ICE officers using tear gas, flashbangs, and pepper balls to disperse crowds.
NPR's Meg Anderson in Minneapolis. Parents in the Twin Cities are now standing guard outside of their children's schools. Many are wearing whistles to warn when federal agents are nearby. Many people are too frightened to leave their homes in Minnesota. A bipartisan congressional delegation is in Copenhagen. They're meeting with Denmark's prime minister and other government officials. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, their visit comes after President Trump repeated comments about wanting the U.S. to own Greenland.
Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware is leading the delegation, which includes Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina. The group will meet with government officials and business leaders. The trip is aimed at turning down the temperature and reaffirming U.S. support for Denmark. As President Trump continues to call for a U.S. takeover of Greenland, Democrat has announced plans to increase the country's military presence in the North Atlantic and Arctic. The U.S. is part of a 1951 treaty that gives rights to set up military bases on Greenland with the consent of Denmark and Greenland itself. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Copenhagen.
A federal judge has dismissed a Justice Department lawsuit against California. The Trump administration had launched an unprecedented effort to acquire the state's voter data. NPR's Miles Parks reports voter data is usually held by states.
In lawsuits targeting election data in close to two dozen states, all states President Trump lost in 2020, the Justice Department argued it needs the data to make sure states are following federal election laws. But the federal government has never had access to it before, and federal privacy laws are strict on how such data can be gathered. In dismissing the lawsuit, Judge David O. Carter wrote that the government's request is, quote, unprecedented and illegal. And in a related case this week, a judge in Oregon also indicated he was tentatively planning to dismiss a DOJ suit there. Trump and his allies say the country's voter lists need more scrutiny specifically to root out non-citizen voting, which has never actually been proven to be a widespread problem. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are higher. It's NPR. Initial results are in from Uganda's presidential election. Ugandan election officials say six-term incumbent president Yoweri Museveni has more than 70% of the vote. Opposition candidate Bobi Wine has less than 20%. Wine and his supporters have been consistently harassed. Ugandan officials also cut the internet during the vote yesterday. A court in South Korea has sentenced ex-president Yoon Suk-yeol to 5 years in prison. That's for his short-lived imposition of martial law in late 2024. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul that's the first verdict in eight criminal cases filed against Yoon.
The charges against Yoon included obstruction of justice. Yoon barricaded himself in his residence last year and deployed bodyguards to prevent police and investigators from arresting him. He was also accused of excluding cabinet ministers from a meeting about his martial law decree and falsifying and destroying documents to cover up his actions. The judge said that although Yoon's offenses were serious, he showed no remorse. Yoon's lawyer said the verdict was politicized and Yoon will appeal it. In a separate case, Yoon faces charges of insurrection. Prosecutors have called for the death penalty, although South Korea hasn't executed anyone in nearly three decades. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
State health officials in California have issued their second warning this season about death cap mushrooms. So far this season, 35 people have gotten sick after eating them. Three people have died. Three more people needed liver transplants after eating death cap mushrooms. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
I never knew I had a wonderful wife until the town went dry.
When you think of Prohibition, you probably think of flappers, bathtub gin, and gangsters. And when you think of cities associated with the famous amendment, you probably think of Chicago and New York, not Granite Falls, Minnesota. That's the hometown of Andrew Volstead, the U.S. representative behind the short-lived 18th Amendment. Prohibition transformed this relatively obscure politician from the prairie into a household name when the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages was outlawed in 1920. Even though Volstead, as a member of the Judiciary Committee, merely sponsored the amendment, his name was forever associated with it. Volstead wanted to be remembered for his other work in Congress. Mary Gillespie from the Granite Falls Historical Society explains.
He really was proud of the Capper-Volstead Act that allowed farmers to form co-ops because he wasn't a farmer himself, but he owned farmland, so he knew the importance of that.
After he lost his seat in Congress, Volstead never liked to discuss prohibition. Still, he will always be associated with a movement that tested the values of the nation.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Venezuela's leading opposition figure came to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Trump for the first time and presented him with her Nobel Peace Prize.
Maria Corina Machado is making a push to remain part of Venezuela's future after the U.S. military operation that led to the seizure of deposed leader Nicolás Maduro. Trump has sidelined Machado and is backing Venezuela's acting president, who at the same time yesterday was in Caracas giving a defiant and at times compliant speech before lawmakers.
For more, we go to NPR's South America correspondent Carrie Khan, who joins us from Rio de Janeiro. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
So Maria Corina Machado gave her Nobel Peace Prize, at least her citation, to Trump. Why?
She told a reporter she presented it to him as, quote, a recognition for his unique commitment with our freedom. Trump did confirm he accepted it on social media. He wrote, Maria presented me with her Nobel Peace Prize for the work I have done. Such a wonderful gesture of mutual respect. Machado has been trying to curry favor with Trump since she received the prize. Trump has long bemoaned not being awarded it. After the U.S. capture of Maduro, Trump shockingly announced he was not backing Machado. He said she didn't have the support or respect within Venezuela. Recent polling by Bloomberg and The Economist shows she still has substantial support, and her party is widely believed to have won the disputed 2024 presidential election by a landslide.
So let's turn to the person that President Trump is backing in Venezuela, the interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, who was obviously a part of the previous regime. She was giving a big speech in Venezuela at the same time that Machado was in D.C. It was kind of an interesting split-screen image. So what did Rodriguez say?
The timing was extraordinary. Rodriguez gave a scheduled speech, a State of the Nation speech. She was stepping in for deposed President Maduro. Rodriguez has been walking this balancing act. She tries to appease hardliners in the government with defiant talk while also making sure not to upset Trump. And yesterday she definitely did just that. She's saying, look, pretty much, our country was attacked, invaded by the strongest military in the world, a nuclear power, so we have to resume diplomatic relations with the U.S., and we can't be afraid to do that. But then she added, if one day I go to Washington, she says it will be on her terms.
Lo haré de pie, caminando, no arrastrada. Lo haré.
I will do so standing tall, not being dragged, never crawling, she said. She says she's also open to foreign investment in the state oil industry. The Trump administration has already announced it's begun selling Venezuela's oil.
Did Rodriguez say anything about releasing more political prisoners?
She did say there is a massive release underway and it will continue. And what she says is this new era of tolerance of opposition in Venezuela. Families of prisoners are still holding vigil at prisons and waiting for releases. Here's Aurora Silva. She's at a maximum security prison outside Caracas. She's been waiting for days for her husband, who's a member of Machado's opposition party, to be released. He was picked up in the widespread repression following the disputed 2024 presidential elections. She says they need to fulfill their promise of this massive freeing of prisoners, and she says, and finally end all of our suffering and pain. You know, they've been waiting there for days, overnight, in the cold and in terrible conditions, waiting for these releases. The government says more than 400 prisoners have been released. Rights groups say that number is in the dozens, and there are more than 800 political prisoners still in jails in Venezuela.
That is NPR's Carrie Khan in Rio de Janeiro. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, for more on what's next for Venezuela, we've called up Eduardo Gamarra. He's a professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University. Professor, I saw that Machado dropped off her Nobel Prize at the White House, and she left with what appeared to be a Trump-branded gift bag. So aside from that, what do you think she walked away from in this meeting?
Well, that's an interesting question because, in fact, I think what she finally obtained is a face-to-face meeting with Donald Trump, something that she's been seeking for a while. In fact, she's been an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump for the last few years, but yet she had never had this face-to-face with him, and he wasn't too receptive of her, as you know, until now. So she's gained something in the sense that he's recognized her. And at the same time, I think President Trump is able to kind of bridge this gap that he had, somewhat critical in the Venezuelan community, which saw his closeness to Delcy Rodriguez, the current interim president of Venezuela, as problematic. So this way, the president is able to say, yes, I'm talking to both of these women, and he's leaving open the possibility that Maria Corina Machado will be the person leading the democratic transition, although we clearly don't know when that will be.
Right. It's almost been 2 weeks since everything went down in Venezuela. I know that a lot of people want answers quickly, but is that enough time to actually come up with a plan?
No, clearly not. And I think the calculus that the administration has taken is one that they've repeated it a number of times, which is the only possibility of stability in Venezuela today is in fact working with the very regime that they haven't deposed, and the only way to pursue the Trump administration's objectives of securing control over the oil industry and of long-term investment in the oil industry is in fact working with this regime, working with Delcy, and working with all of the other questionable individuals, some of whom form part of the indictment against Nicolás Maduro.
There was a poll that came out this week by the Caracas firm Meganalysis, and it surveyed more than 1,000 people. 92% of Venezuelans feel grateful to Donald Trump. Two-thirds believe the U.S. is not in control. And Machado has said before that she would bury socialism forever in Venezuela. So I'm wondering, what would be the reason why Donald Trump would not back Corina Machado right away?
I think that the whole issue has to do with stability. Uh, the The unfortunate reality is that Maria Corina Machado, while she enjoys overwhelming support in Venezuela and among the exile community, she doesn't have a structure of that would allow her, in fact, to ensure political stability in Venezuela. And many of the things that she would have to do, and which probably Delcy Rodriguez will have to do, is deal with the narcotics trafficking structures that remain intact, with the gang structures that remain intact, with the colectivos, the militia structures that remain intact, and probably above all, controlling the military and the intelligence institutions that are largely controlled by Diosdado Cabello, the other man indicted in Washington, in New York, but who still forms part of this governing coalition.
In the last couple of weeks, Professor, Venezuelans have told me that Delcy Rodriguez, to them, is as complicit as Nicolas Maduro has been for the state of Venezuela. If that indeed is the case, I mean, when you think about what this future for Venezuela looks like, how could it possibly include anyone in Maduro's government?
Well, there's an old adage in Latin America that transitions like this, and particularly problematic transitions, imply swallowing frogs, right? And that essentially means that in order to move Venezuela forward, you have to work with some rather heinous people, including Delcy, who has been a part of this regime and was very close to Maduro, in fact. And so in the near future, I think working with Delcy is still going to be key, despite her terrible background.
All right, that's Eduardo Gamarra, professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to a major story in this country. It's about college basketball. It's the latest sport at the center of a gambling scandal. Federal prosecutors announced criminal charges on Thursday against more than a dozen former players and the men who allegedly organized a scheme to bribe them to rig games. NPR's Becky Sullivan has the details.
The scheme began back in 2022, prosecutors say, when two gambling influencers started to work with a former college basketball star who was then playing overseas in a Chinese professional league. Here's lead federal prosecutor David Metcalf.
The defendants would identify a game in which a corrupted player had a team that was favored to lose, and then they would bribe said player to deliberately underperform so that his team would lose by more than they were favored to. They would bet for them to not cover the point spread.
After winning hundreds of thousands of dollars on the Chinese games, prosecutors say, the three brought their enterprise home to the U.S. They looped in other conspirators with connections to the college basketball world, then began to recruit players. The indictment describes cash bribes of $10, $20, sometimes $30,000 for players to throw individual games. The conspirators allegedly focused on small-time teams and players who weren't stars, who might be motivated to earn some extra money.
This is a pretty pervasive corruption scheme. We're talking about dozens of games, athletes, 17 teams. I do view it as historic.
In all, nearly 40 players were recruited to try to rig games, prosecutors say, from schools like Alabama State, Fordham, and DePaul. Among the allegedly tainted games were some that were meaningful for NCAA tournament seeding and at least one postseason conference tournament game. Gambling has become an inescapable part of the sports landscape ever since the Supreme Court opened the door to widespread legalization back in 2018. Last fall, federal authorities unveiled indictments involving NBA games and two Major League Baseball pitchers. Prosecutor David Metcalf says in this case, the victims go beyond the gambling platforms.
The fans, right? You also have the honest athletes, the teammates of these players who are working their tail off. Everyone is victimized by this case. It's not just the people who lost money on the sports betting games. That's what I hope I would convey to you, is to think of the victims in this case in a far more broad way.
In a statement, NCAA President Charlie Baker thanked law enforcement and said the integrity of games is of the utmost importance. The organization has run its own investigations into teams and players involved, he said, with 11 players already banned for life. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXE. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Again, that's psa@kaxe.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, for 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. President Trump repeatedly promised a replacement for the Affordable Care Act throughout his first term in the White House.
Now, a year into his second term, Trump says he finally has a plan.
Today, I'm thrilled to announce my plan to lower health care prices for all Americans and truly make health care affordable again. We're doing things that nobody's ever been able to do. We're calling it the Great Healthcare Plan.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin covers health policy and is with us now. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what are the highlights?
Well, what came out yesterday was a fact sheet. It's very sparse on details, and the policies mentioned there are not really new. It's kind of like a greatest hits of Republican health policy ideas packaged together. You've got the idea of tying drug prices to what people pay in other countries, health savings accounts, and better price transparency.
But is this the Affordable Care Act replacement that President Trump has been alluding to for years?
Well, it doesn't mention repealing Obamacare. And again, it's short on details, but it seems like they'd like to let people use federal dollars to buy plans that don't offer comprehensive coverage. These are sometimes called skinny plans or junk plans. That could seriously weaken healthcare.gov, which has plans that can be expensive, but they offer essential benefits and don't discriminate if you have pre-existing conditions. Also, there's one idea that was conspicuously missing from Trump's plan, and that is extending the enhanced subsidies for Affordable Care Act plans. And the timing is really telling, since this announcement came yesterday on the day that open enrollment ended for healthcare.gov, although it's still open in a few states until the end of the month.
You know, there have been a lot of stories about people dropping coverage. You've done a lot of those stories.
Yep.
Do you know yet how open enrollment went?
Well, enrollment is down for the first time in 5 years. Obamacare marketplaces have hit records every year since the enhanced subsidies were passed. Last year, total enrollment was 24 million, but now those extra subsidies have expired. And earlier this week, the agency that runs healthcare.gov released data showing 22.8 million people had picked a plan as of January. Cynthia Cox of the nonpartisan research organization KFF says that surprised her.
Honestly, the sign-up numbers look stronger than I expected. I thought that more people would have dropped off by now.
But she says the numbers aren't final. They show how many people auto-renewed or selected a plan, which is basically like putting it in a shopping cart online. It doesn't show how many people paid their premium, and premiums are sky high compared to last year for a lot of people. Cox also said some people may have signed up hoping Congress would make a deal to revive the enhanced subsidies that make premium costs so affordable.
But how likely is that?
Well, there was a big boost to momentum when the House passed a bipartisan extension earlier this month, but talks in the Senate seem to have slowed down, and Republican senators involved in the talks seem to acknowledge that Trump releasing this plan the day open enrollment ended sort of takes the wind out of those sails. Although Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, for one, says she is not giving up. She told reporters on Thursday after Trump's plan came out, quote, "I don't think it's too late to try to salvage something."
That is NPR's Selena Simmons-Devent. Selena, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's Friday, so time for StoryCorps. Today, we revisit an interview recorded in Florida 20 years ago.
What would you say is your biggest accomplishment so far in life?
Marrying you. It certainly made me the happiest.
Me too.
That's Earl and Bobby Quinneville. Bobby recently came back to StoryCorps to remember that conversation.
The StoryCorps silver trailer had come down to the Tampa Bay region. I had to do a little bit of talking to convince Earl to be recorded.
And I remember the first time I saw you, you were running a restaurant. I stopped in for breakfast. And it really was love at first sight.
You know, I fall in love with you every morning over again. I do. But we've got an age difference.
Yeah.
I'm just starting to notice it after almost 28 years.
Yeah.
When Earl and I found each other, I was 25 and he was 50. And age did not mean a thing. But in our interview, I needed to ask a question because deep in my heart, I needed to have the recorded answer.
What I ask is, if you should go before me, you got to give me some wisdom on how to survive without you.
I just want you to be happy. Whatever you needed to do to be happy after I'm gone, then do it. If it means getting remarried, fine. If it means not getting married, fine. Whatever makes you happy.
But what if I can't be happy without you?
You're just going to have to learn how, kiddo. Assuming that I go first.
That's true.
I plan on being around forever.
Earl was diagnosed with cancer and passed away on July 9th of 2020. He was 92. I still, on occasion, will play that whole interview to hear his voice.
You know, I'm not really sure what's going to happen after we die. I know what I hope will happen.
What's that?
I hope that there is an afterlife and that we'll get together again. But if that isn't the case, then dying is not the most terrible thing. It's just the end of something. It's going to be a tiresome thing to live with for a while because you're going to feel lonely. Don't park yourself in the house and mope. Eventually, it'll pass.
I was lucky enough to where I had him for 42 years in my life. I was blessed. I still am. Our legacy together is an example of how you can have that kind of love. Just endless love.
Let's end on a happy note. I love you.
I love you too.
Bobby and Earl Quinneville. Their interviews are archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 140,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company.
This is NPR News.
How do you deal with grief? It's a very personal question at the center of the video game Clair Obscur Expedition 33.
There's like a deep-seated human need, I think, to try to find some light in the darkness.
I'm Juana Summers. We speak to the game's lead writer about the art of storytelling in video games. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon on KAXE with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few minutes, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date, January 16th. Cloudy skies today, patchy blowing snow possible, highs in the mid-20s this morning, temps dropping throughout the day into the single digits, northwest winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. Snow possible tonight with mostly cloudy skies, lows in the single digits below zero, wind chill values into the 20 below zero range, blustery northwest winds. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy to partly sunny with highs 3 below to 4 above, northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Saturday night, our lows 10 to 15 below zero. And for Sunday, snow is possible, especially in the morning, mostly cloudy, highs in the single digits above. If you have an unwanted vehicle, you can donate that to KAXE. It is easy, towing is free, plus your car donation helps keep people-powered radio going strong. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started, or you can call Heather during business hours, 218-326-1234. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their annual meeting this Wednesday, January 21st, 5 to 7 at the library. You can learn about the work they did last year and how you can get involved. A light meal will be served. And the American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady. You can find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. Mike Stirk will present the local history talk Echoes Behind the Pit next Friday, January 23rd, 1 o'clock at the Hoyt Lakes Public Library. Learn about the Erie Preliminary Taconite Plant and how the town of Hoyt Lakes was born. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us psa@kaxe.org.
On today's date, January 16th, 2015, crows are seen and heard. And while this isn't the surprise it used to be, it certainly is a bit of an occurrence that is a bit unusual, because in the 80s and 90s, crows were not seen nor heard in northern Minnesota from about mid-December to about mid-February, maybe first part of March. At that time, they would be down in the Twin Cities or maybe as far south as Iowa, basking in the warmth of those southern climes. But lately, our winters have been much more mild, and the crows, at least some of them, have been spending their winters here in northern Minnesota. So it makes it a bit more of a challenge when you see a large black bird. Is it a crow or is it a raven? Used to be, it was always a raven. Now, you've got to look a little closer.
Where we pull up a chair to one of our members' kitchen tables. We get to know them a little bit better.
Good morning.
So why do you listen to KEXE, KBXE?
Because it is the best radio station I have ever found. I don't remember when I started listening to it, probably 20 years ago. And you have science, phenology, which I love. You are kind people. You respect everyone. You are always on the side of those who need help. I just wish I could clone you and take you all over the world. I've been wanting to say this for years, and I tell everybody I know to tune in. You know, you're the kind of people that make the world a good place. Friends, coming back in style.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. There are thousands of federal immigration agents in Minnesota, and protests against the Trump administration's immigration crackdown continue. Those protests grew after an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer shot and killed Renee Macklin Good in Minneapolis last week. Another Department of Homeland Security officer shot a man in the leg this week during an arrest. And that has all raised questions about the training immigration officers get and the protocols they're supposed to follow. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has been looking into this, and she's with us now to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the administration has made it clear from the beginning it wants to increase deportations. It wants to do that fast. And to do that, it's going to hire a lot more immigration agents. So that invites the question of just how these people are being trained. So what are the concerns about that?
Immigration advocates have questioned how immigration officers are being trained to not just conduct arrests, but also engage with U.S. citizens and particularly protesters or observers. For example, the woman who was killed in Minneapolis, Renee Macklin Good, was a U.S. citizen. I will note the officer involved in that incident had been with the agency for several years and not a part of this larger hiring surge. But, you know, I've been looking over the ICE and Customs and Border Protection handbooks, which both provide various procedures for how and when to use force, such as discharging a firearm, but it can also depend on the situation.
So say more about what situations these officers are now facing in their jobs.
So officers from both ICE and CBP are already interacting with the public in various places. For example, the Department of Homeland Security often provides security at major sporting events and national events. And that's different from an immigration arrest at the border, which is different from an immigration arrest in a parking lot in the interior of the country. But over the past year, there has been an increase in what the administration and immigration arrests call at-large arrests, which means they're out in the community, in the interior of the country, like on a street, for example. And we've seen other agencies such as Border Patrol play a bigger role in these operations. Of course, you know, they are facing a lot of protesters and public resistance as well. Mark Brown is a use of force expert who used to train ICE officers, and he's now a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He says ICE officers might be working in new situations under President Trump.
When you have incidents, you have to look at training. You have to look at, was there a gap in the training? Is there something? You can't train for everything, but training has to adapt to what's current.
But in all these situations, and in my reviews of the handbooks, there is a certain amount of discretion on what agents are allowed to do.
And say more about that. What do you mean by discretion?
So let's look at the fatal shooting of Renee Macklin Good by that ICE officer in Minneapolis. The officer, Jonathan Ross, was in front of her vehicle when she was at the wheel. The agency said that he was acting in self-defense when he shot her in her car. Law enforcement experts and officers and officials have pointed out that these officers are often told not to shoot into vehicles or step in front of them. ICE's own handbook includes this as well. It explicitly says that firearms shall not be discharged solely to disable moving vehicles, but it also gives DHS officers the right to use deadly force when there's, quote, questionable relief or belief that a subject poses imminent threat. That second part is what the administration is really leaning into, though it is important to note that the claim that she was a threat is disputed by local leaders and contradicted by video evidence. The shooting is also particularly still under investigation. And a lot of claims from the administration that it is a felony to interfere is not always that simple. Just because the administration thinks something's a felony doesn't mean a judge and court will agree.
That is NPR's Jimena Bustillo. Jimena, thanks.
Thank you.
There's not just a surge of immigration officers in the Twin Cities. There's also been a growing number of right-wing influencers to document the officers' arrests and clashes with protesters. Both are part of a White House strategy that has used social media content to justify and promote its increasingly aggressive immigration policies. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been reporting on the administration's online presence. Stephen, a lot of the administration's messaging around what's happening in Minnesota seems to be online. President Trump posted on his social media site threatening to use the Insurrection Act, and the White House is posting memes on their account. What's their strategy here?
Well, for the Trump administration, content is governing, and governing is content. The push into Minnesota with a record number of immigration agents is inspired in part by a viral social media video with unproven claims of fraud. More agents means more protests. More protests bring the Trump-friendly influencers to document the scene. And all of these videos are in turn used to justify more agents and the government's response. Beyond ICE agents, the administration has also sought to freeze different types of federal aid to the state and end temporary protected status for Somalis, all of them accompanied by memes and trolling of Democrats. Whitney Phillips for the University of Oregon calls it combat sensationalism.
It's combative, it's highly provocative, but it's also focused on a very particular kind of fight between real Americans, which maps onto MAGA, and then this imagined liberal other.
Stephen, what other ways are you seeing this online strategy?
Well, in the last 2 weeks alone, there have been a fire hose of examples. The Trump administration using social media to drive policies and to speak to targeted audiences. You've got the defense secretary monitoring the situation in Venezuela with tabs of X, the social media platform behind him. You've got agencies posting QAnon slogans and songs associated with white supremacists. And the official White House account has repeatedly asserted that the United States is seizing Greenland while using popular meme formats of the day. I asked the White House if they have any concern that this high volume of posts that feels more like a campaign feed might be something that turns people off or leaves out those that are less online. A spokeswoman told me, quote, "The White House has an authentic style and unmatched communication strategy because it's led by the greatest communicator in the history of American politics, President Donald J. Trump."
All right. So what's been the pushback to the strategy?
Well, in Minnesota, you've got people like Governor Tim Walz who have compared it to reality TV. They say it's reckless and inflaming tensions after an ICE agent killed Renee Macklin Good last week. In the last year, there's also been a number of controversies around the administration using AI-generated images to attack opponents, posts with dog whistles to extremist content. It's also led to a rise of other politicians mimicking this trolling antagonism, like Governor Gavin Newsom and Governor Kathy Hochul. Where does this all go? We don't know yet. Some of these experts we talked to for this story say a coarsening of politics could push people away from engaging. But on the other hand, they do say viral videos of masked federal agents using aggressive tactics against people could prompt people to tune back into the news and demand change in the administration's policies around ICE.
All right, that's NPR's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Sometimes in the cold of winter, it's hard to think about getting outside. But winter, some people think, can form our character and can bring out the best in us. That's why when you tune into KEXC, you hear about the events going on in our region, whether that means live music or outdoor opportunities at places like the Saxim Bog in Meadowlands, or skating at the Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, or maybe it's the walks with the Cohasset Parks and Rec Department. So many things are happening throughout our region, including cross-country and downhill skiing. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what's happening in your community during the wintertime. Text 218-326-1234.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Friday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, National Native News, and just after 7 o'clock, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Cloudy skies today, patchy snow is possible with highs in the mid-20s this morning, then dropping throughout the day into the single digits. Blustery northwest winds, 10 to 25 miles per hour. Cloudy tonight, lows near zero, and northwest winds continue. For tomorrow, partly sunny to mostly cloudy with highs 0 to 4 above. Northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. For tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, lows 10 to 15 below zero,
And for Sunday, chance of snow, mostly cloudy, highs in the single digits. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota connects youth who have been exploited to safe housing, resources, and non-judgmental support. Help is available 24 hours a day by calling 866-824-3770. And the 20th annual Back to Basics Sustainable Living event is Saturday, February 7th at Pine River Bacchus School. The morning keynote and vendor fair are free and require no registration. But if you'd like to participate in workshops, register and find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Thank you so much for choosing KAXC this morning. We continue now with Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Progressive Insurance, now hiring for virtual and hybrid employment, offering opportunities for professional development and career progression. Position details can be found at careers.progressive.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Game of Thrones ended in 2019. Now, since then, the prequel House of the Dragon has given us more backstory about the fight over the Iron Throne. And the Targaryen family is back on HBO this weekend in another prequel.
They charged me to be a good knight, to defend the weak and the innocent. And I swore that I would.
This one is called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. NPR's critic Glenn Weldon has gotten a sneak peek. He's here with his reactions, Glenn. So, I mean, what did you think? I mean, will Game of Thrones fans be into it? Because it looks a little bit lighter.
Yeah, it is. It's lighter, it's funnier, it's shorter. It's just 6 half-hour episodes. It's also a lot smaller in scope. This whole series, A, takes place over the course of a few days in a single location, a jousting tournament. So this is kind of Game of Thrones for everybody who hated Game of Thrones, right? There's no magic, there's no dragons, there's no lore, there's no incest, there's no naked women. There's some naked men, but there's no naked women. Plus, it's got a beginning, middle, and end. Imagine that. And instead of being told from the point of view of these rich ruling families, our point of view is that guy you heard, a schlubby underdog, a poor wandering knight who just wants to do the right thing. The one thing it does have in common with both Thrones and House of the Dragon is some pretty gnarly violence, so be warned, and the fact that Targaryen family you mentioned shows up, and they're exactly the same rich jerks they are in those other shows.
Well, good. I'm glad if I'm not getting nudity, I'm getting violence. At least that. Thank you very much. All right, so there's been a lot of fantasy on TV in the past few years. There's the Lord of the Rings spinoff, the third season of House of the Dragon is expected to be coming out soon, too. Mm-hmm. Is all of this, Glenn, just about capitalizing on IP while these stories have some momentum and interest with viewers?
Yeah, you have to remember that Game of Thrones, despite that disastrous final season, was an unprecedented hit for HBO. I mean, it was expensive, but it had a built-in audience of book readers that only expanded as the show went on, and that's what the industry loves. They love a winning formula. They love a built-in audience, which is why you saw a glut of shows based on popular fantasy series cropping up. We had House of the Dragon, which you mentioned, and that's been hugely popular. Rings of Power, sure, but also The Witcher and His Dark Materials and The Wheel of Time and Shadow of Bone, but the landscape's changed a lot since all that happened. The pandemic and the writer's strikes have tightened the purse strings, and a lot of those shows I mentioned just got canceled, and you're seeing a lot of sweeping epic fantasy series not getting greenlit right now. I think A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is kind of perfectly placed for this moment because, yes, it's set inside this huge fantasy setting, but it's a very small story, a very grounded story that doesn't require viewers to do any homework, and it's got a much smaller budget. I mean, there's lots of blood, but it's not like corn syrup and food coloring is that expensive.
You would hope not. I mean, you know, inflation and all, so you never know. Now, Game of Thrones all started with the books of George R.R. Martin, and I know that fans of the text have been eagerly, breathlessly, impatiently awaiting a new one. So what do we know about that?
Not much. I mean, we know it's called The Winds of Winter. We know it'll be the sixth book in the Song of Ice and Fire series, which is what Game of Thrones was based on. We know it was originally intended to be the last book, but now there's going to be a seventh book after that one. I mean, in theory, because the man is 77 years young right now. We know he's been working on this for the last 16 years. He keeps updating fans with his progress, or lack of same. So, look, in the meantime, we've got this little show, which is based on the first of three very short Martin novels about this one kind of good-hearted knight and his squire just trying to get by. Now, that's not what his fans are starving for, as you mentioned, but it is a small, good, real thing. It actually exists, so they can take some comfort in that.
All right, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms debuts on HBO this Sunday. Glenn Weldon is a host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Glenn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we should note that HBO is a financial supporter of NPR. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
With Area Voices, we're trying to discover what makes an artist an artist, what drives them, what inspires them, and most importantly, why it's important to keep creating.
Theater, in particular, is an art form that sort of asks for people to test the borders and find out what people are excited about and what people are interested in, but also to challenge audience members.
I think every artist wants to show a feeling of some sort. I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, art, I don't know anything about it. It's not my thing, and I can't critique something because I don't know anything about it. I think that's wrong. I think you're either touched by a work of art or you're not. You like it or you don't like it. And I think when somebody paints with passion, that's what they're trying to convey, is a mood, a feeling.
Tune in Wednesdays on The Morning Show to hear more Area Voices.
Popular kid on campus, community colleges.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port and onboard cultural enrichment. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on Think or Swim. More at Schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. For the fourth fall in a row, enrollment in community colleges was up, this time up 3% from a year earlier. Now, that's according to a new report from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. Why is interesting. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that.
41-year-old Titus Dominic has always loved to cook. So this fall, he enrolled in a culinary program at Columbus State Community College in Ohio.
The ultimate goal would be at some point to be able to own my own restaurant.
Dominic worked as a cook on an aircraft carrier when he was in the Navy years ago. For the last decade, he's worked as a commercial truck driver. He hopes this program will launch his new career.
At some point, I have to pull that thread and say it's time to go for it.
More people are doing the same as Dominic, going to community college with the aim of getting a particular job. There's been an increase in people seeking associate's degrees. And Matthew Holtapple, who leads the research team at the National Student Clearinghouse, says there's been an even bigger rise in short, job-focused certificate programs.
It speaks to students of all ages seeing the value of these short-term credentials. You know, there's a wage payoff that students are seeing, and they see it as clear steps toward the career or the job that they want.
Another driver of growth, more high school students are now taking community college classes.
I think this kind of program helps students get into college sooner, so it helps students learn they can do college work and they can succeed in college.
Holtapple points out that community colleges aren't necessarily gaining at the expense of other schools. There has also been an uptick in the number of students going to four-year colleges. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Checking my market screens 2.5 hours or so before markets open officially. S&P futures are up 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are up 0.6%. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has quietly removed web pages that used to say mobile phones are not a health risk. The Wall Street Journal noticed the change. Robert Kennedy Jr.'s Department of Health and Human Services has ramped up a new study of the health effects, if any, of the radio waves emitted by phones. The FDA pages used to say, in part, the weight of scientific evidence has not linked exposure to radio frequency energy from cell phone use with any health problems.
Marketplace is supported by Ascendium Education Group, which is committed to making education and training after high school a reality for learners from low-income backgrounds. And by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses with customizable coverage options as unique as your business. More at progressivecommercial.com.
The country, and especially people in Minnesota, remain on edge and upset after the killing of Renee Good, a 37-year-old U.S. citizen, by an ICE agent in Minnesota. This with more ICE agents and other federal officers deployed to the area. Amid all this, a key set of regional voices has been noticeably quiet: executives for many of Minnesota's leading corporations. There are many. For more, I'm joined by Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell in St. Paul. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, David.
Minnesota has headquarters for some very high-profile businesses. I'm thinking 3M, Target, Best Buy, General Mills, many more. Some of them have been right at the center of the immigration enforcement, immigration raids in their stores, employees detained in some cases. There have been calls for firms to protect employees and customers. What have been the public statements from big companies, given everything we've seen in the past week or so?
Well, David, there have been very few public statements so far. Generally, companies have said, look, they can't stop immigration officials from entering public spaces, and that's right. But here's the thing. Prominent executives served on nonprofit boards. They weigh in on workforce issues, and they tap their corporate foundations and personal pockets to support community initiatives. So with that history, with that background, corporate Minnesota's silence about increased federal immigration enforcement is striking.
Now, the administration's promise is that strict immigration policy will lead to more and better jobs for citizens. But, I mean, we've seen calculations, right, that this immigration enforcement has had negative effects, a negative impact on Minnesota's economy.
Well, local businesses, they're saying we have fewer customers. Employers say some workers are too afraid to come for their shifts. Farmers, restaurateurs, construction firms, just to name a few of the vulnerable industries, warn repeatedly about labor shortages and production bottlenecks from the crackdown.
What explains the retreat from the public square by large companies in Minnesota on these issues?
Minnesota's leading companies, they're national, they're global corporations, and the local economy is less important, says Lewis Johnston, professor of economics at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University.
When you're looking at those kinds of things, it's better to keep quiet or to be as uncontroversial as possible and not take a side.
And Chris, the general political environment is volatile and the rhetoric can be intense, some will say vicious.
Executives seem concerned that if they raise objections, their company might find itself dealing with political retaliation, regulatory scrutiny, perhaps a consumer boycott, or some combination.
Once upon a time, CEOs, I think, were more prone to taking stands on public issues. The term was CEO activism.
Political scientist Samuel Huntington famously dubbed this mindset Davos Man, a multinational corporate elite confident in his problem-solving insights involving the world's most pressing issues. These days, CEOs are focused on navigating multiple uncertainties like tariffs and geopolitical upheavals. But here's the thing, David. You know, in Minnesota and elsewhere, there are concerns that silence will exact a long-term price. Here's R.T. Rybak, a former mayor of Minneapolis.
The bigger threat is if we lose our competitive advantage of having a culturally fluent workforce that continues to grow.
Rybak is now the head of the Minneapolis Foundation.
Chris Farrell is Marketplace's senior economics contributor, speaking from St. Paul. Chris, thank you.
Thanks a lot, David.
Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietinen. Our engineers are Tessa Block, Brian Allison, and David Schreck. In Los Angeles, I'm another David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, we have National Native News at 6:30. We'll also hear talkbacks before 7 o'clock. Always great to hear from our listeners. You can text us your thoughts on our programming, 218-326-1234. Cloudy with patchy blowing snow possible today. Highs in the mid-20s this morning, dropping down into the single digits throughout the day. Northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Cloudy tonight, lows 0 to 4 below with blustery northwest winds, and mostly cloudy to partly sunny tomorrow. Highs 0 to 4 above, northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour once again. And for Sunday, chance of snow, mostly cloudy, highs in the single digits.
Good morning. There are thousands of immigration agents.